Hello and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. My name is Ansi Kamel. I am an editor-at-large at the journal Ad Fontes, and I am joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, Colin Chan Radimer, the poetry editor at Ad Fontes, and Reese Laverty, the senior editor of the whole operation. Gentlemen, it's great to be here with you.
How long of my week?
Colin's just making mouth noises instead of talking. No, okay.
Good for you, Reese. Good for you. I'm glad for you that it means that much.
Yeah. All right. Well, Colin, what are we going to be talking about today?
Today we're talking about Bible translations. I don't... Something about the Bible. So Anzi texts us.
For once. Says,
I want to talk about the Bible. And Reese and I were like, you know, that's kind of really...
You're so lame, Anzi.
Come on.
No, I didn't want to talk about the Bible, because as we know, only Reese knows anything about the Bible on this podcast. I wanted to talk about Bible translation.
We're going to talk about Bible translations. And so, you know, I guess you have opinions about Bible translations. Which translation is best? Should it be translated? Does everybody need to be learning Coptic? You know, these kinds of questions. I don't even know. Does it relate to your hatred of people making Bibles in foreign countries?
It's not foreign countries. It's only fascist dictatorships that I have a problem with people making Bibles in. But we can talk about that some other time, maybe.
The essential question is, what translation should we use? Should we be translating it? This is people have said the Davenant Institute, to kind of tie it to our work in a serious sense. The work of the Davenant Institute is essentially a work of translation. Literally, we translate some things. We also modernize things. We also take old ideas and try to bring them back into, refashion them and put them into the conversation.
Right.
You know, this is something that is very Protestant, we would say. It goes back to Ad Fontes, right? It's the name of the podcast, the name of the journal. You know, Martin Luther, the various other reformers translating the Bible into the vernacular. Is sort of controversial at the time of the Reformation. We're all aware of those things. The question then is, you know, at this point, it's not like we have one English translation. I don't know. What do you guys use? I use a KJV. I grew up using an NIV. You know, I don't have a lot of opinions about it. I basically switched to KJV because I wanted to learn to read English in a way that makes it easier for me to read Shakespeare. And it's kind of, you know.
Auden told me to be aware of people like you. Who read the Bible for its prose. Colin?
Yeah, I know.
It's next, right, you're going to commit a social science. Come on.
I have committed many a social science. So what are your... You seem to have a strong opinions about these things. My point in saying all this is I can understand having strong opinions about this. Yeah. I don't have strong opinions about this. Should I have strong opinions about this?
Yeah. So I wanted to start, before I give everyone my strong opinions... Because they will be forthcoming, as our listeners, I'm sure, expect by now. You know,
they're limbering up. You can see them on Ansi's screen right now. They're stretching.
No, but I want to start with a problem, and it's a problem that Schleiermacher posed explicitly. No, okay, so so Schleiermacher has this really famous essay. And its name is escaping me right now. No, it's actually very famous. Apparently, philosophers think that this is the only thing that's still philosophically significant that he wrote. But it's basically an essay on translation, right? In this essay on translation, he says, okay, what is translation trying to do? Translation needs to take a text that is in another language, which means it's in another sort of conceptual world, and it needs to make that text comprehensible in a new language. That's the task of translation. So you take a text, it's in another language, which means it has different concepts, different idioms, different ways of speaking. You need to make it comprehensible in your own language. So you're trying to somehow bridge two different worlds, the worlds of the text and the worlds perhaps of the text author, and the world that you're in as a translator.
And we've talked about this a little bit on this show before. I remember the episode about the Psalms. I think we were all talking about Hebrew poetry as a poetical form. English poetry is completely different. How could you ever go from the one to the other? And yet we manage it.
Right. And so what Schleiermacher says is that there are two basic ways of bridging this divide. The first is to take the world of the Bible. He's thinking about the Bible in particular, but translation in general. To take the world of the Bible and to make that world closer to our own, to sort of bring the thought world of the Bible to us. And he basically thinks that Luther has this 1530 letter on translating. This is Luther's approach. Luther says he Germanizes the Bible. Sort of brings it into German and makes it German. A lot of contemporary translations do this, like the New Living Translation or the Message is a kind of extreme example, so extreme that Eugene Peterson didn't want it to be thought of as a translation. It's a paraphrase. Mm. But the point is that
oh, it's a translation.
One school, what?
It's a translation.
I mean, Peterson didn't say it. He said it was not.
No, but I think based upon your own definition of translation, you just get.
I mean, I think it would be a very loose translation. Yeah. But so the goal in that is to sort of bring the world of the Bible to us, to make it comprehensible to us. And so you'll find Peterson in the Message talking about like cancer. As you know, and it's like obviously no one in 1000 BC knew what cancer was in the modern sense. They might have known about tumors, etc. So that's one option. The other option is to try to figure out how to bend our language and our concepts and to fit them to the like language and conceptual world of the text that's being translated.
Yes.
And so very literal Bible translations, this is how they market themselves, right? That we're just giving you word for word the Greek.
The word like Leviathan in English sort of does that. Gets us
in the
closer.
King James.
Yeah, it gets us, because it's getting us closer to this kind of chthonic, horrifying,
mystical
beast.
Yeah.
Lovecraftian.
Right.
Yes.
And the King James actually does this, right? The King James transformed English because it so effectively bent the language around, in particular, Greek. And if you know Greek and you read Greek, you can see the King James translators doing this. And you're like, oh, that's why English has that turn of phrase, because that's
I've
in Greek.
I've actually heard that Luther's German translation did this to German as well, that it sort of Greekified German in a more thoroughgoing way than French ever has been, right? So maybe English and German are similar in that sense, but the French never went through the same similar process. And I've heard that that's actually why German and English philosophers are superior to French philosophers. I've heard that argument made before, because the languages themselves have gotten syntactically closer to the Greek. Therefore, when they go back and read the Platonic literature, they can do metaphysics in a way that corresponds to the conversation that's being had.
Yeah. I mean, I think both things are always going to happen in translation. English
no
will
statement
become...
on it. I just have, yeah, it's an yeah, argument yeah. that's parallel to this.
No, it's, but I think that kind of gets to the point where that languages themselves are actually malleable. And so, but anyway, so Schleiermacher thinks basically that the goal of translation should be to fit the conceptual world of people who are reading to the original text and the thought world of the original text. Mm. And that, I think, is the approach generally of the King James Bible. That's the approach of the NASB, I think is what it's called, the New American Standard Bible, and more or less the ESV. And then the NIV tries to sort of cut the difference, right? It tries to do both, to be all things, all people. So that's kind of the contemporary American, at least, translation landscape scene and how they map onto these two problems. But I'm just curious, what do you guys think about that problem before we get into like the particulars of translations? Like, what do you think about this question of gulf and how to bridge the gulf? And if you don't have an answer, I have another anecdote that I can, talk about that provides some interesting food for thought. But
yeah. So, people sometimes pass it as the difference between dynamic equivalence, which is sort of close to the meaning and the sort of overall gesture or the gist of it, and formal equivalence, being closer to what the actual kind of words on the page say. And contemporary Bibles, NIV being the more kind of dynamically equivalent, and the ESV being the more kind of formally equivalent. I get all the impulses behind a leaning towards a kind of dynamic equivalence that wants to really, get into the headspace of the readers, and not overly be stuck in, let's say, a pre-first century Hebrew mindsets, or he, way of speaking, construction of phrases. I think that often discounts. There's even a theological move in that which discounts the kind of the scandal of particularity in that the Lord in his providence did decide that he would reveal himself in the people of Israel in the Hebrew tongue, with images and kind of reference to natural phenomena which are not universal. So my best friend's dad just recently completed a 30-year translation project of the Bible into an obscure tribal language in the Philippines. And reaching a tribal people, you come across problems like they have never seen a sheep and do not know what a sheep is. So how do you convey, obviously, the whole interconnected matrix of biblical imagery related to sheep and sheep and shepherds and so forth. Stubbornly, annoyingly, the Lord decided to reveal himself in a place where sheep exist and make that a rather central part of the scriptures. And so if you're going to make sort of, moves to say, well, what's the equivalent of a sheep out here in the jungle,
introduce them to shepherding, make their life simpler.
So there are, moves you have to make there. And if you hang your hat fully on the kind of dynamic equivalence and you want to get into the headspace of the readers, you are often in danger, I think, of sort of discounting and looking down on the fact that in his providence and wisdom, the Lord revealed himself at a particular time in a particular way. So that is often my worry with very strong desires to say we have to put this in the idiom of the people listening. And I think the success of vernacular Bibles and the way it can actually shape the languages that it enters into kind of proves to you that that's we can overegg that anxiety too much, because actually scripture is such that it can just turn a language upside down, let alone other things. Yeah,
I like the argument that you're making, Ansi, but I guess I'm gonna
argument. What argument am I making? Have I made an argument?
Yeah, you're offering. Well, you're beginning to make an argument, I guess we'll put it that way, because you're making the distinction between these two things, and you're disparaging Eugene Peterson on one side as you're doing it.
I wasn't disparaging him. I have the utmost admiration for Eugene Peterson.
As a translator, you're disparaging his translation.
I was going to, but I have not yet disparaged it, Colin.
I'm going to throw the red flag. We're going to replay the tape. I'm pretty sure there was a little bit of disparagement that was going on.
Okay, all right. And just on Peterson, because we keep mentioning him, on the history of the message, he didn't write the message as, I'm going to write a book for everybody everywhere in the English-speaking West that will be in their modern idiom. He began by first paraphrasing Psalms for his specific Presbyterian congregation. And just it was incredibly tailored to a very small demographic, just his congregation.
Yeah. And he pastored a very small congregation for decades. I mean,
I think it was him getting sort of blue-collar, guys to understand the Psalms. Right. His aim always being to take them beyond what he'd written into, a more common translation of the scriptures. And then this just kind of catches on and gains in popularity, and bang, the message comes about. But really, it's rooted in a very particular thing for him, rather than, English speakers at large.
But I guess I would approach the whole issue of translation from the perspective of at least the beginning points of thinking through the just philosophy of language per se. Max Müller wrote that mythology is a disease of language, and Owen Barfield disagreed with that. What Müller meant by this was that, we get myths because we have these words and we need to attach them to something, and so we make up little stories. And Barfield says in Poetic Diction that his counter theory is that the opposite is in fact the case. That mythology is not a disease of language, rather language is a disease of mythology. So what comes first is this pre-linguistic story, and the words are always emerging out of those stories. If that's the case, then I think you can make the argument that provided you have the story correct, and then we would have to have an argument about what the story is, but provided you have the story correct, for example, the story of God who has a son who comes to the earth, who then tells a story about two brothers, one screws up and the other one's the older brother and he's also kind of a screw up, and then the dad comes out and runs to them, and then mm-hmm. you know, like, you get all these stories right in the structural level of the story, that, you know, if you could pull that off, the language is going to kind of emerge out of that, and you don't have to be quite as concerned about tying, you know, their language to their language and syntax, or tying their language and syntax and trying to update it to communicate to us, because the essential piece might be that kernel on the inside.
So is this like a, I mean, would you say this is a structuralist argument where you think basically that, like, language stories operate according to structures, and once you figure out the structures, the precise words, they're important insofar as they indicate the structure, but not insofar as, like, you're actually, you need like a kind of verbal equivalence or something between them?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, these guys would not want to call themselves structuralists, so okay. I would say it's not just on a historical level, that's not the people who came up with this. They're rather trying to preserve human poesis, human storytelling, as mm-hmm. as an activity that is meaningful, and that the stories are meaningful as stories, not just as you know, like arbitrary conjunctions of words or something, or as like placeholders for some other further thing that's going on.
So, but I guess what I'm trying to say is what's important is the story, not the telling of the story, right? Would that be the argument that you're making? Not sort of the way the story is told?
Yep.
But it's the story itself.
And that actually, yes. And so, you know, I think a structuralist could understand this, and a structuralist would say, you're doing structuralism.
Right.
These guys are not going to want to let you say that, but that's fine. Okay. You know, a structuralist could do that. And yes, I mean, they literally, you know, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien both run with this in their various works on fairy stories and on mythology, and say things like, what you mean by myth or fairy story is the kind of story which, even if it's told very poorly, still contains within itself a certain power. So I'll use Cormac McCarthy's The Road as an example when I teach this, and I'll say mm-hmm. something like, it's a true myth, because even if I don't use the artistry McCarthy uses, and I just tell you, it's after the fall, civilization's falling apart. Mm-hmm. No houses have any power left. We're in a nuclear winter. And the only person who you know exists is this father and this son. And winter is coming. They have to get to safety. It's like, whew, you know, that's not told with any artistry at all. I literally just did that off the cuff. It still contains a certain inner kernel of power as a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I guess where I have concerns about that is that I do think that, like, particular concepts are important, and the signs, you know, I mean, to invoke a little bit of like Frege, the signs that correspond to the senses of words, and the senses which correspond to the things themselves, that actually it's important to try to preserve the concepts that are being signified by the words. So, you know, I mean, we could imagine,
but that's only preserved inside of the tradition which uses them, right? I mean, that's the problem with the Fregean conception of this.
Well, I guess, I mean, so I'd want to make it like concrete. You know, if you think about
just to throw a little Gadamer into the pot while we're doing it.
This is going to become some, like, you know, post-Fregean, like, analytic philosophical and then like literary theory duel or something. I don't know.
But you had another thing you want to talk about Schleiermacher's thing too. So we don't have to get lost in this.
Shtick.
Well, maybe we can sort of, maybe I'll put it this way, that I think I take your point about stories. I also think that it has always been the case, just historically, that Christians have thought a good deal about the way that they present the scriptures at the sort of linguistic in the non-technical sense, the verbal level, right? At the level of the words that they use when they translate. So to give a kind of interesting example, this one's fun on a number of levels. We were talking earlier about the King James and how English itself has been transformed by the King James adoption of or rendering of certain Greek and Hebraic idioms into English. What about a language that has not been shaped by the Bible? Right. So, for example, early medieval Arabic translations of the Bible. So interestingly, the Bible existed first in Arabic before the Quran. But the Quran, because it is the very speech of God through the angel Gabriel to the Prophet Muhammad,
according to Muslims,
becomes held up as the sort of exemplar of Arabic. So God speaks Arabic, he speaks perfect Arabic, and so the Quranic Arabic is the perfect Arabic. So Christian translators...
Is Arabic influenced by the Quran in the same way that English is influenced by the KJV? Is there some thread of, comparable?
Probably way more, actually, even than Arabic is much more, classical Arabic at least, is much more influenced by the Quran than even English is by the King James. It's hard to measure that sort of thing, but it's to the point where certain kinds of elocution, certain kinds of ways of putting things have to be expressed, if you're writing at a high register, have to be expressed in Quranic idiom to be right, to be proper, to be classical, right? And so Christian translators, as they are trying to, translate the Bible from Syriac into Arabic or Greek into Arabic, basically have different opinions about the fittingness of Quranic diction to translate what's in the Bible, because they want the Arabic to be really good Arabic, and so they want to use these phrases and these words and these concepts, but those words and phrases and concepts are Quranic. And so they...
So you're saying that this is like kind of Schleiermacher's analysis of the way translation can work on languages would be to say that when Quranic translators are translating into English, they're trying to bend English into the Quranic. And so it is a sort of a colonization project of the English at a linguistic level.
Right. And so a lot of translators who translating the Bible into Arabic avoided any Quranic language.
That's a lot of, just listeners. It's not a lot of that he said. These are the kinds of things people are going to clip this stuff out, and we're going to get raked over the coals. Okay.
But yes, many English translators of the Bible into Arabic chose to avoid Quranic diction completely. Others intentionally incorporated high classical Arabic phrases and stuff to basically prove that the Bible could subsume and integrate into itself all of the insights of Islam. So there are like different ideologies.
Are we talking about stuff that has like actual sort of conceptual weight, or just kind of turns of phrase and tone?
Both.
Both.
Yeah.
It makes me think, if anyone's seen or read Silence, was the novelist named Shusaku Endo, and Scorsese made it into a movie several years ago with Liam Neeson and Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver, Catholic priests in the 1600s.
I have a review of it out there on the internet somewhere.
In Japan, kind of does, yeah. Point made, I think both novel and the film, and I believe this is historically accurate, is a decision by some of the Jesuit missionaries to use effectively the Japanese word for God, which means the great sun, rather than essentially to import, Deus, the Latin word for it. And so this is what Christians are going to call God here. Basically means that Christianity is pegged as one of the reasons why Christianity just will not take root in Japan, because that decision to use a native word freighted with all of its meaning, rather than to boldly attempt to colonize the language in some fashion, means that the Japanese just never kind of ascend beyond their, we would say just pagan, materialistic, bounded view of God. Back to my question, is it just conceptual stuff or just stylistic stuff? He said it's both when it comes to that.
Yeah, I think it's both. Or words, maybe words that have a particular conceptual. So, for example, I'm reading a medieval translation of Psalm 1 right now, and it uses the word kafir.
Into Arabic?
Into Arabic, yeah. So it's a 12th, 13th century translation from Greek into Arabic, and it uses the word kafir, which is unbeliever, the Islamic,
for the wicked.
Yeah, the right, for the wicked in some way. And so there you can kind of see, like, it actually, this word has a technical meaning in Islam, and there are, like, juridical debates within Islam about, like, what is the, you know, the unbeliever, the status of the unfaithful, the rebellious, you know, these sorts of questions. And there you have, like, a Christian, whereas the 19th century Arabic translation of the Bible avoids that word. It doesn't use it in these contexts. And so, you know, you can kind of see how it's kind of what Rhys is saying. It has particular conceptual resonances in the language that it's being translated into. And, you know, do you want to risk, I mean, maybe put it this way. One worry, I take it, that Rhys was expressing is that the Bible is for everyone, but it's not to everyone. Right, God spoke it to a particular people at a particular time in a particular place. It's for all people, but it wasn't addressed to all people. And so one of the worries about translating too dynamically, so to speak, is that you sort of give people the false impression that the Bible is to them and that there's no distance that needs to be crossed for them to properly understand what's going on.
But don't you think it is to them?
I mean, I think at that point we're just equivocating about what two and
two,
four
two
are
can be
in
said
one
in
sentence.
Many modes, but I'm happy with that way of phrasing it.
I don't know. I mean, you know,
that's sort of like, you know, kind of exegesis and context.
If we're talking about the Bible, that's fine. I agree. If you're talking about the Word of God, then I would have to fight. I would have to.
Yeah, but the Word doesn't speak Hebrew or Greek, Colin.
I know. Well, it does. I mean, you know, it speaks English too.
Well, right. I mean, he doesn't speak only Hebrew or Greek. I mean, and that, I think, I take it, is actually a very important difference from, that separates actually Christianity from both Judaism, at least rabbinic Judaism, and Islam, right? Is that God actually,
yes.
So does not speak, he speaks a language sort of to communicate to us, so to speak. But it's not like Hebrew or Arabic are the sort of Ur languages, you know, the ones that God actually speaks, right?
We don't have to have a inner orientation as being the lesser brother to some other linguistic community. However, to your point, we have to admit, as we pursue a knowledge of God, that we have to go to these other resources in order to gain access to the inner workings and meanings of the revelation that he's given us.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's important that it's not just one, right? You know, I know Greek. I don't really know any Hebrew. I took a Hebrew class at seminary. Didn't stick at all.
As many language classes at seminary.
But you have to actually, you know, stew in these things just as you would in the philosophic tradition, to sort of, you know, pick up on various aspects of what's going on in the scriptures. There's all kinds of, anyway. Yeah.
I mean, this is really another way of putting this. Maybe we should have Ryan Hurd on, you know, to discuss this, but another way of articulating this question.
Ryan Hurd does argument... not discuss. Ryan Hurd lectures.
not on my watch. But like the argument between the humanists and the scholastics, do you actually need to know Greek and Hebrew in order to read the Bible well? You know, the humanists said yes, for kind of on the grounds that I was just giving, and the scholastics said no. You know, I mean, and so that Latin, you know, the Bible translated into Latin is fine because ultimately the things are all the same and we can have different words that signify the things, you know, all of that stuff. So I guess maybe what I'm trying to say is that Schleiermacher gives us this problem, and he frames it really helpfully. But once you're aware of it, you kind of see it popping up everywhere. You know, it's in 8th century Arabic translations of the Bible. It's in, you know, 14th century, 15th century debates about Hebrew and Greek knowledge in the West. It's, you know...
I used the term in our conversation, you know, of the imagine the American Muslim scholar who's translating the Quran in English. And I said that there's a certain version of this in which they might be trying to colonize the English language itself in order to make it amenable, right, to the American linguistic psychological substrata, to the Quranic position on various philosophical, theological issues. I don't feel comfortable thinking of this in terms of colonizations for precisely the reasons that Reese was pointing out, I think, by taking us to silence. Do you have another word you would use to sort of talk about that? Because it's not quite, there's something more going on there than simply translation. Because as we've said, we can distinguish translation in various types. We can throw different buckets out there. But then there's a particular kind of translation, right? Which is like doing this work to you, the community that is receiving the translation, that's attempting to form you on a linguistic, grammatic, syntactical level in the kind of same way that the poetry of a community is going to form them, right? So poetical art has the ability to mold and change and shape the way a community speaks, the way a community thinks, therefore. What would you call that? I don't like saying colonization.
I guess goes to the way the different words people will use to describe what Christianity tries to do with philosophy. So you say, you know, Christians baptized Hellenistic philosophy, or they evangelized Hellenistic philosophy, you know, using evangelism in a sort of qualified sense. You know, you can go and evangelize the people, but you can also go and kind of evangelize their language.
I would say sanctify.
Well, I guess back to the issue, the one from silence then. That is a sanctification of language, because if the only word you can use
to talk about God is the Son,
for God is the Son, then that's sin. That is you oppressing the truth, seeing God's eternal power and divine nature, but refusing to acknowledge Him and swapping Him for the glory of created things. So sanctify may well be a helpful one.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I just sort of, I think that, you know, while I do think that languages should try to bend themselves around translations, I mean, ultimately, I agree with Schleiermacher. Languages should try to bend themselves around the original languages to try to, like, get the reader as close to the original language as possible. I also think that it has to be the case that in the providence of God, no language is unfit for His self-disclosure to men. I mean, I just think that you have to think that if the gospel is for all people, as the people they are, it simply is the case that God can and will and does reveal Himself to them in the language that they use. You know, and so I think that you kind of have to hold both of these things in tension. Because again, as I do think that it's important to recognize the particularity of the event of revelation, right? It, you know, particular time, particular place, particular people. You can't sort of erase that. And yet also, it's for everyone. And so there is no people that is unfit as they are to receive the gospel. I just sort of take that as probably basic. But anyway, so that's my thoughts on translation. So what translation should you read? Obviously, you should read the Van Dyke translation, undertaken by Presbyterian missionaries, you know, and native Arabic speakers to translate the Bible from the original Hebrew and Greek into Arabic in the 19th century. Actually,
you know how many of our listeners that's useful to?
No, can I tell a quick funny story? Can I tell a quick funny story? So, I don't think I've told it on the podcast before, but in the 16th and 17th centuries, the West and East reestablish contact.
The
Christian world. So Islamic-controlled Middle East has contact with the Christian West. And the Patriarch of Antioch writes to the Pope, and he says,
"Friend of the show.
Hey, Pope, I really want a new translation of the Bible into Arabic. We have all these different translations. I want to standardize them. I need your help because I have only our Arabic translations. What I need you to do is find the best Hebrew and Greek manuscripts and also Arabic manuscripts from elsewhere in the world. And I need you to help me translate the Bible into an Arabic that is fit for divine liturgy and for public reading and so forth. And we need one translation, one standard translation." And so the Pope, you know, he gathers a commission and like all the best, you know, people are on it. They've got their theologians doing their thing. And the Pope comes back with a counter proposal and he says, "Check this out. We've got this Bible. It's called the Vulgate. It's the one God spoke. So what we did is we translated the Vulgate word for word into Arabic. We don't know anything about classical Arabic, but we translated it for you, and now you can have a pristine Arabic translation of our Latin text, because the Vulgate, according to the Council of Trent, is the authoritative Bible. Anyway, I just think that's... And the Patriarch of Antioch said thanks, and then ignored it, and then did his own translation. But anyway... But
good, Max.
Sorry?
But you have that we have that Arabic text, you're saying?
Yeah. It's like a facing... Oh, it's a facing translation. You have like the Latin on one side and then the literal Arabic rendering of the Latin on the other side.
Wow.
And then everyone uses the Van Dyke translation, which is a 19th century Protestant one. Anyway, but that's kind of...
What translations do we all use generally in our personal use here? Ansi, what do you use? You're reading in like four different languages all the time, I guess.
Well, I was... normally I use actually the Van Dyke or the Septuagint or the Greek New Testament. But I generally try to recommend either the King James or the ESV. At this point, I'm sort of at the let's find the least bad translation because they all have serious shortcomings. So I like the King James in English. But
I read the King James in English, and then I sit there with a Greek next to it, and I try. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah,
Reese, what do you read?
I went through very much the kind of cage stage post NIV into ESV track some years ago. You know, our church uses the NIV, and that's what was generally had always used them, but discovered the ESV and was like, oh yeah, this is the thing, guys. You know, we've been being cheated out of, you know, the actual words of God for years, so come get this.
The actual words of God in English.
Yeah. Yeah, and I still use the ESV. I'm less militant about that than I used to be. If only because the more I teach, the more I find that even when I go to the ESV, there will be times where the ESV makes these kind of translation decisions where I'll expect it to do much better, and I'm just baffled. The worst I've found recently was doing Exodus last term with our young people, going through the plagues. And the mystery of, you know, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart and whatever. It took me reading a book, I think I mentioned on the show, that Alistair Roberts recommended, The Exodus Almost Passed Over by Rabbi David Foreman. He's obviously Jewish. For to be the first person to ever really tell me that two different words are used for the hardening of heart all throughout this. And that is important. And yet the ESV... Mm-hmm. Of all translations, totally obscures this fact and just translates the whole thing as God hardened Pharaoh's heart throughout, when in fact two different words are used.
What I've tend to do is, and just the one thought I had going into this is on Bible translations. One of my favorite tools. So you know, Bible, the internet's a terrible thing, but Bible Gateway has a tool.
Bible Gateway is great. Yeah,
you can put side by side translations. If any of our listeners don't know this, this should be profoundly helpful for your devotional life. And I do this whenever I'm going to teach anything from scripture. You can look up and put side by side translations. And so you can do, you know, ESV, NIV, KJV. I think that you can even do other languages side by side together.
Oh, yeah.
And I have found that to be extremely, extremely helpful in my teaching. So,
yeah. Yeah. The one last thing I'd say is that the King James, the Hebrew is pretty dicey. Like their understanding
of unicorns
Hebrew,
and dragons.
Yeah, their understanding of Hebrew, you can tell like there are places where they just really don't quite, they just don't get it.
I mean, I can't imagine I haven't used this joke on this podcast before, but it's a good enough joke and it's appropriate enough. I'm going to have to use it twice. So, you know, the joke is, people say the King James Version translators didn't know Greek and Hebrew. But the response is, yeah, but the modern translators don't know English.
Don't know English. That's right. Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
You're saying that Schleiermacher would claim the opposite. Actually, what happened with the KJV is not so much that they knew English, rather they knew how to take English and bend it to the will of the original language of Greek. But you're saying they don't really do it very well for Hebrew.
As well as for Hebrew. Yeah, I mean, another way of putting it would be to say the King James translators, along with the Book of Common Prayer, made English, right?
It's sort of, precisely. You know,
they knew Greek, they knew Hebrew, and they made English.
Well, the KJV was heavily based on existing English translations already,
right.
In place at the time. Right. Just to All right. Well, so while we're on resources, along with that, if anyone doesn't know it, Step Bible, STEP, Scripture Tools for Every Person, which is put out by. It's made by Tyndale House, who are the New Testament Institute in Cambridge, very orthodox evangelicals, mostly. Similar to Bible Gateway, but you can kind of click on any word and it will take you to the kind of Hebrew root word. You can find how many times that's used. It's got all these kind of searching bells and whistles. I will always use it when I'm prepping any kind of Bible teaching stuff. So it's Step Bible. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. All right. Well, on that note, we got to shift to the What We're Reading segment. After a completely, I don't know, that wasn't a failure because we were just talking. And, you know, when you just talk, can a conversation really fail? But we did not come to a conclusion about what the best Bible translation methodology is.
we were gonna settle the best Bible translation.
I wanted you to solve Schleiermacher for me, Colin, and instead you just give me the schlock about myths and language, and I don't know. No, anyway. So, but anyhow. So, what we're reading, maybe we can revisit this at a later date. But for my own part, what I have been reading, I'm trying to even think. Kavafi. Is that how you pronounce his name? Mm-hmm. Kavafi.
I mean, what do I know about
Kofefe.
How to pronounce this Egyptian? It's Kofifi.
It's Greek, sorry, isn't it? He's Greek.
It is. He's Greek. Well, he's Greek.
Yeah, but he lived most of his life in Alexandria. So Colin put me onto this poet. It's a and I found one of his collection of his poems, and it's like a nice edition because it has the English translations, like the sort of authoritative English translations, but it has them side by side with the Greek. I don't really know, 19th century Greek, but I know enough kind of like Attic to sort of cheat it and kind of check up on the work of the English. And it's been really great to read. I mean, some of these poems are really, really fantastic. And it's kind of fun to spot check the translation. So that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, he's a delight and he's a charmer, and he doesn't fit neatly into, I mean, you know, modern American poetry readers are, you know, if they read him, it's like, you're in a different universe.
Yes, like, yes. It's
reading medieval poetry. It's more like reading, it'd be more like reading like Russian poetry or something.
Yeah.
You're just, it's different land. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Colin, what are you reading?
I was recently reteaching a section from Charles Taylor's Secular Age. So I was reading Charles Taylor's Secular Age again, and it's actually quite fun. So this is like, if you ever have a Roman Catholic friend who's, kind of going a little trad, you know, tell them, one of my favorite philosophers is a Roman Catholic. We should read it together, and then get them into Charles Taylor, but don't let them Wikipedia or anything. Just be like, just gas them up about it. And then they start reading it. They're like, really good stuff. This guy's brilliant. See, the Roman Catholics are awesome. And then, of course, he ends up being like a huge lib, which is hilarious.
Is he really?
Well, I don't know about huge, but yeah, the conclusions of Secular Age, if you read it to the end, are like, yeah, we need to modernize the papacy and the sexual ethic, and it's going to be okay. Just calm down. And so it's like, not what you would expect of the trad cat version of Roman Catholicism. He represents a different branch of the genuine intellectual tradition of the Roman Catholic Church. But the first two thirds of it is really just more descriptive of what took place from his perspective of bringing about secularity. And then the last third is like prescriptive, what should we do about it? And that's where he gets a little wonky. Anyhow, the thing that, I wanted to say is at the end of chapter 10, he's talking about how do you go from, what is it that happens that takes you from, the medieval world where everybody's a Christian to the modern world where it's not just that everybody's not a Christian, but it's that like everybody believes every crazy thing. It's like you swing a dead cat, you hit somebody, and they have some crazy theory about the world. They took an ayahuasca trip, and now they think there's a dark, shadow monster chasing them, 24/7 or some crazy thing. And like, that's the meaning of life, is to get away from the shadow monster. And he says the first step actually is you have to go from one thing, which has a counter thing, to four things. So he says initially you go from Christianity to secular humanism. He says that there's a certain branch of humanism which makes atheism possible for a large group of intellectual elites, but that these two things produce a counterfold of two other things. And so Christianity is transcendent, and sort of
There's a transcendent enlightenment version of Christianity and the Enlightenment. There's a imminent enlightenment version of the Enlightenment, which is the humanist, secular humanist. You have the kind of Protestants and the humanists in his analysis. And then on the flip side of that, you have the transcendent counter-enlightenment, which is the Romantics. And then you have the imminent counter-enlightenment who wants death, you know, anti-humanism. This is the Nietzschean, you know, quadrant. And I just thought it's actually a really helpful little bit of intellectual mapping. You know, we might disagree that that's all the Protestant is or whatever is the Enlightenment version of Christianity. Or maybe we would want to grab that and say, I really like that. You know, see Rome, you're stupid. You don't have the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And that weirdly is kind of his position. Anyway, I could talk about Charles Taylor for a long time. Reese, stop me. What are you reading?
Yes, Reese, please stop him.
Shakespeare.
Ah, yes. How is the... Karen... You're still on the Shakespearean
years. So, Colin, still on back the... to the secular age. yeah, Reese, all right,
Shakespeare. I'm still on my Shakespearean a year read through. We're recording this right at the end of January, so it's going well thus far. I'm on Richard II, and this is a good week for me because Richard II is maybe my favourite Shakespeare play, which is regarded as maybe his most... poetic and kind of there's this sort of elegiac feel throughout the whole play. So if people don't know, Richard II is deposed by Henry Bolingbroke, who becomes Henry IV because of sort of various foolish and unjust things that he does, and yet he's this kind of beautiful, ethereal, a kind of anointed king-like figure. And so even his kind of loss, and even though he sort of in many ways seems to forfeit his natural right to be a ruler, yet that loss is deeply felt. And then to whatever extent you think the history plays of Shakespeare are kind of meant to be taken together, kind of that loss sort of echoes throughout the remaining kind of history plays that come after that of Henry IV, V, VI. Richard III, I mean, not so much Henry VIII, which is an odd play. I'm trying to memorize bits of Shakespeare as I go through, just as a sort of general mental exercise, and it's nice to be able to kind of drop a little bit of Shakespeare.
I'm very jealous.
It actually started because my son, who's 2 years old, his favorite thing right now is attacking this dragon-shaped tent that we have. And he likes to charge at it with his little wooden sword and go, "Fight dragons, Dada! Fight dragons!" So I started quoting bits of Henry V, and so I decided then to learn the Henry V battle speeches so that I can charge around quoting Henry V while we fight this dragon. So yeah, it's good fun.
Well, give us a quote. What's a Henry V battle speech that you've got? Just very, you know, short, something in the background.
Once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with our English dead. In peace, nothing becomes a man so much as modest stillness and humility, but when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, conjure up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favoured rage. I'll stop there. I've learned the whole of that speech now.
Wow. That's really good.
That's stirring, Reese. You should do a dramatization of Shakespeare for the
years of musical theatre, darling. Yes.
All right, and on that, Reese, what are we spotlighting today?
For this, we are going to spotlight, which should be out by the time this episode is out in public, our winter 2023 edition of Ad Fontes in print. This is a great selection of contributors, some big names I'm very excited to have in there, actually. So Gerald Bray, who many will know as a historian of Reformation stuff in particular. And he wrote a big book last year or two ago on the history of Christianity in Britain and Ireland. And he's written a book, essay for us on the myth of Celtic Christianity, which is nice and spicy. If you, you know, think people want to get into weird and wild Christianity, did such a thing ever actually exist? Read it and find out. Glenn Butner.
There's like a whole cottage industry of evangelicals who...
Well, like Celtic crosses and sort of pan pipes for Jesus and whatnot, very glad to have that in there. Glenn Butner, who people may know from kind of various dogmatic and Trinitarian-y stuff, has written a survey of global Trinitarianism for us, which is very interesting. He sort of gets into questions of Indian Christians trying to build a kind of form of Thomism based on, you know, Indian philosophy from the 8th century in the same way that kind of Aquinas uses Aristotle. and sort of the questions around that, not dissimilar from the sort of translation questions we've discussed today. Matthew Hoskin, one of our teaching fellows, an essay on Leo the Great, among the reformers. Leo, big in the Council of Chalcedon and Christology. Nathan Johnson, who is Davenant teaching fellow at different points and New College Franklin lecturer, gives us a reformed overview of the question of Old Testament sacraments, which is an essay I've wanted to exist for a while, and then Nathan pitched it to me. I was like, great, I'm glad someone has finally done this. And then reviews from Brad Littlejohn, our president, Michael Riggins, our assistant editor, and John Wilson of Books and Culture, who many people may know, who's been a great supporter of Ad Fontes for a while, always says very nice things about us, and then we're very glad he's written for us. And then Colin has, of course, assembled a wonderful selection of original poetry in this issue as well. Malcolm Guite, the great man himself, appears again. Dan Rattel, who people may know from being published far and wide, and Colin himself has a contribution here. So,
being the poetry editor of a magazine is I can subject readers to my verse.
Indulgences.
Yeah, Colin was like, I'm a good poet. I'm just going to put this in. That's exactly how that works.
Those are the privileges. So yes,
yeah,
so
know, get, Colin, if I had known you were just going to publish yourself when you asked to be poetry editor of Ad Fontes while I was,
well, you're not the boss anymore, Anzi.
I know. Reese, you got to.
He
hold
first
him
just
in
sent
line,
me a string of his rhyming tweets, and I was like, no, you've got to tidy this up into a sonnet. So the Winter 23 edition is out now, and you can go and subscribe online at Ad Fontes Journal. We.org or .com. I can't remember right now, but you'll find it.
All right. And if you like what you heard today, give us a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify. And if you didn't like what you heard today, Colin, what should they do?
You need to go learn Greek. You need to go learn Hebrew. And then you need to go learn Arabic. And you need to give a translation to the Patriarch of Antioch, which surpasses any translation previously used, and tell him the Pope didn't send you. And if he accepts your translation, makes it the authoritative translation, not just for devotion, but also liturgy of the community of worshipers underneath his care, then and only then can he give us a 1-star review.
I dig it. And on that note, we are the editors. This is the Ad Fontes podcast, and we will see you next week.